Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozworski, and welcome to the show. Today's show looks at the political economy of land in Canada and the Canadian state's relationship with First Nations as mediated by land. I'm happy to bring together two guests who deal extensively with these issues and pose challenges to rethink the way land is governed and so too the structures of Canada's political economy. My first guest is Hayden King. Hayden is Anishinaabe from Beausoleil First Nation in Ontario, and he is the director of the Centre of Indigenous Governance at Toronto's Ryerson University. My second guest is Lynn Gale, an Algonquin Anishinaabe researcher, writer, and activist. She holds a PhD in Indigenous Studies. First up, my interview with Hayden King about his provocative recent article in the Globe and Mail. Hayden, you recently published an article in the Globe and Mail under the relatively stark title, The First Nations Crisis is About Land. First of all, what gives land such primacy in understanding the relationship between settler Canada and First Nations even today?
Well, I think the relationship is structured around land. I think, you know, the newcomers that came to Canada, their primary motivation was land, and throughout their time in this place, they've undertaken a lot of initiatives, laws, policies, activities that aim to get that land, and that means dispossessing Indigenous peoples who are the owners of the land. So this relationship, the fundamental relationship that exists between Canadians and Indigenous peoples is about land, and it always has been about land. And so, you know, in the contemporary context, we think about all the socioeconomic challenges that Indigenous peoples face. I think that, you know, my argument, and I think many others would argue that most of them stem, the root of those challenges are from the dispossession of and the alienation from our lands.
And I wanted to ask you about this recurring metaphor. I think this ties in well with what you were just saying. This recurring metaphor in your piece in the Globe and Mail, and that's this dish with one spoon. First, maybe you could say what the origins are of this, both as a symbol and an institutional arrangement.
Right. Well, the Globe and Mail piece, I was, you know, speaking about the territory that I come from, you know, the Great Lakes area, the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee territory, and you know, the institutions that have governed this territory historically are, you know, I think relatively unique in the, you know, thinking from a contemporary circumstance or contemporary context, because, you know, we conceptualized our homes as these places of shared sovereignty, right? Like these zones of mutual responsibility and obligation. So, you know, the dish with one spoon is a metaphor. Some people call it a treaty for how Anishinaabe people and Haudenosaunee people, two distinct sovereign entities, existed together in the same geographic entity, right? So, I mean, this challenges fundamental notions of exclusive sovereignty, or, you know, that the type of politics practiced by states with that privilege exclusivity of land ownership, and the dish with one spoon asserts that, you know, we can accommodate diversity on the land. And so today, you know, I think that a lot of academics and activists are thinking about alternatives and alternative futures. But we kind of get stuck, I think, a lot of the time, you know, just kind of like the capitalist, anti-capitalist rhetoric, or state, anti-state rhetoric, or, you know, colonialism, anti-colonialism discourse. And we get kind of trapped in these binaries. So I guess in that piece, I just wanted to, you know, think through a little bit, you know, what, you know, if I'm not entirely sure what the equivalent of decolonization is in the settler colonization context, you know what I mean? So just thinking through alternatives, you know, in that piece, I mean, it was only 800 words, but, you know, in that piece, I'm trying to say, you know, maybe we can imagine alternatives in the context that we currently live, you know, and it was a provocative proposal, right? I mean, I'm not going to expect the state or the settler colonial regime to adopt my proposal and accommodate diverse legal orders. But it's just an exercise in thinking through those alternatives.
Maybe just to keep going with this metaphor for just one more second. I mean, you ask a good question in your piece, and I wanted to ask it here as well. You don't have to give the same answer, but basically, you know, what would the dish with one spoon look like today?
Yeah, well, in the piece I made, I distinguish between areas where where treaties have been created, and structure the relationship between Indigenous peoples and Canadians, and then areas where there have never been any treaties. So, you know, in the territory that I come from, there are numerous treaties, pre-Confederation treaties, you know, Confederation era treaties, and then of course in places like British Columbia, there are no treaties. So I think if we were to take the concept of the dish with one spoon, which is really just about accommodating diverse political economies, and recognizing the sovereignty of the rights and responsibilities of those political economies, it would look a little bit different in both of those treaty and non-treaty areas. So in the treaty areas, I just essentially suggested that we take, you know, our little postage stamp reserves and we blend them with provincial crown lands, and then Indigenous peoples take over the, you know, the quote-unquote management of those areas, that territory, privileging Indigenous perspectives, Indigenous relationships with the land, Indigenous relationships with, you know, non-human treaty signatories, all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, you know, the province just doesn't disappear. They, you know, they contribute to the administration and, you know, co-management of those lands. But the key point is that Indigenous perspectives are privileged. Right. And then in the non-treaty areas, well, I mean, this is, you know, I mean, this is a completely different context. This is where those agreements about how to live with each other on the land don't exist at all, for the most part. And so communities there are literally, you know, they've faced invasion and illegal occupation. So when we think about what, you know, the dish with one spoon is probably not a good metaphor for the West Coast, and there are many other metaphors, you know, Lulu, Wet'suwet'en, you know, whatever Haida metaphors for how to live on the land together. But, you know, my proposal said that we recognize the sovereignty of Indigenous nations in the Pacific Coast, and essentially, they become landlords to settlers. You know, taxes go towards Indigenous nations. All legislation that's created by provincial governments is vetted by Indigenous nations, and hopefully, it's a process of collaboration and consensus. In my utopian model, but ultimately, yeah, because you know, Indigenous peoples have never agreed to share the land, and you know, then they should still exercise their rights and their responsibilities on the land. So yeah, that's the big key, the key difference between the two areas, I guess.
Yeah, and I think in both cases, it's a bit of a challenge to democracy, really, in some ways, to the understanding of democracy that we have, and again, moving it, I guess, from people to land a bit in some way.
I think, you know, I didn't really write the piece as a challenge to democracy. I mean, I think that democracy is a good thing for all people generally, but it was more of a challenge to the state and the notion of exclusive sovereignty of the state and settler colonialism generally. And when I wrote the piece, I actually got a lot of backlash from, well, not a lot, but some backlash from Indigenous activists that were saying, you know, there's nothing fundamental about your proposal that challenges the state. But the whole point of the piece is to challenge this notion of a singular legal orders, right? I mean, I'm arguing that we should be privileging diverse and Indigenous legal orders on the land. And then, you know, what happens to the state and what happens to exclusive sovereignty when we think about multiple and diverse legal orders on the land? I mean, I think that it starts to fall away, right? So in terms of democracy, I mean, I'm not suggesting that Canadians, British Columbians, Ontarians, you know, non-Native people don't have a say. I think that they do, but there's a limit on their authority, right? There's a check on their authority, just as in the contemporary context in Canada's legal democracy, there's a constitution which limit what laws provincial governments can pass and what Canadians can and cannot do. So this is, you know, the implications of the piece, and again, it was 800 words, but the implications would be that, you know, there would have to be fundamental institutional change in Canada. Now, again, whether or not that actually happens is not the focus of the point. But if we were to imagine it, you know, then there would be a tremendous check on Canadian power. But, you know, I don't know if that's a challenge to democracy, because certainly people should have a say in their future and be self-determining as much as they can.
I think maybe another way of saying that is that, you know, it's not what I took away too from the piece is that, you know, we often think of, well, something went wrong and now here's something to make it go right, but in a kind of sort of tit for tat or compensatory way, and that seems to be the way that, you know, that the state approaches both contemporary treaty making and all the kinds of institutions that are dealing with this legacy that we have. And I think you're trying to say something that's a bit different, that, you know, there's a different connection between the past and sort of, you know, possible future justice that's just, you know, this for that, right?
I mean, I'm definitely, and I think many, many Indigenous communities have since, you know, 1870 been saying that, but even before then, you know, we're not interested in this kind of transactional relationship where we surrender or extinguish our title, our rights to the land in exchange for a couple bucks a year and, you know, a first aid kit or something, right? I mean, I think that model has definitely been called into question for, you know, over a century in a very vigorous way. So, you know, I'm not adding anything new to that discussion, but maybe all I'm saying is, you know, let's just move a little bit beyond the critique, which is certainly valid, to thinking through, okay, well, what does a different type of treaty relationship look like, or a different type of, what does a different governance relationship look like? Well, what shape does our diplomacy take beyond the critique? And, you know, I'm not saying to anybody we shouldn't be critiquing settler colonialism, but, you know, the piece was just, it was just really to kind of think through some of these futures and provoke discussion, really, about some of these futures, whether or not they can be acted on today or you know,
what they require.
Yeah.
All right, Hayden King, thanks so much for your time
today. Yeah, absolutely.
That was Hayden King, director of the Center of Indigenous Governance at Ryerson University. Next, Lynn Gale talking about her article, First Nations Finance Their Own Demise Through Land Claims Process, and more broadly, Ontario's negotiations with Algonquin. So Lynn, you just wrote an article for Ricochet that I thought was very important, in which you argue that the land claims process over Algonquin territory is actually harming the Algonquin Nation, saddling it with debt. What's been the cost of the land claim so far, and how is it financed?
Well, as I said in the article, right now it has cost the Algonquin people $18 million. Now, that would be the money that the Algonquin have received from the federal and provincial governments to pay their expenses. Now, I can't comment on how much, you know, the federal and provincial government spend on their employees.
And this $18 million it's basically a loan for them to cover their costs, but it's understood that it's later going to come out of the whatever the settlement is, right?
Yes, half of the funding comes from the federal government, and half of it comes from the provincial government. But I think I looked it up in my book, because I have a book, the article's based on my book called The Truth That Wampum Tells, My Deboy Went on the Algonquin Land Claim Process. And I looked it up, what I said in there, and it says, I say that the federal government is providing the funding in the form of a loan. And then the Ontario government is funding it through non-repayable grants. I think that that has changed with the provincial government. I think now they're also loaning the money, and I'm not sure what the year was. Maybe after 1990, that's when the provincial government started to offer the money as loan. And yes, the total amount that the Algonquins use is subtracted from the final settlement.
What's the context of this settlement? Looking at it more broadly, what's the history, you know, in as much of a thumbnail sketch as it's possible? You know, where is the Algonquin territory roughly? What's the history of the colonial settlement, and what's the basis for the land claim?
Okay, so that's like a three-part question, right?
Yeah.
So it might be good to pull those questions apart. I think one of the questions was, where is the Algonquins? And the Algonquin and the Anishinaabe, they straddle the Ottawa River. They're on both sides of what is now Ontario and Quebec. And they were recorded there in Champlain's journal. So the Algonquin traditional territory straddles the river. And the river used to unite us. Today it's used to divide us. So then your other question was, I can't remember.
What's been the history of the history of it?
Yes, thank you. So it's a long time coming. I mean, the most, you know, a lot of the nations in Ontario, they have already settled a treaty settlement. They've already negotiated a treaty, as well as the historic treaties along the, you know, the other provinces of Manitoba and Alberta and Saskatchewan. For some reason, the Algonquins were denied, and that, I think, is a really important thing to consider. Why were the Algonquin denied? So although the Algonquin participated in various peace treaties with all the other nations, for example, in 1764, the Treaty at Niagara, they were denied during the historic treaty process, and the Algonquins have a long history of filing petitions and submitting petitions to have their land rights respected, but it was continually denied and denied and denied.
I think that's an interesting thing in your article as well. I found quite interesting that it's already in the 19th century, as you say, you know, as they were petitioning it, there's actually lots of ways that the land was being taken away, that, you know, the tax system was being used, various grants, you know, distinctions along what makes a useful use of the land. What are some of these ways that the land was, you know, was kept away from the Algonquin?
Well, first of all, you know, an influx of settlers were just, you know, taking over the land. But there's also laws that prevented us from collecting monies to file claims and to go to court. And so that was really a really important thing to consider. But then also they gave, actually, another thing they did is through land grants, they gave settlers Algonquin land, but when the Algonquins tried to do the same thing, they were denied. And then the tax system came in where if you didn't have the money, because you didn't engage in the wage economy, if you didn't have the money to pay the taxes that were now applied to your hunting, your trap line, for example, you lost your land through that way.
Yeah, so a sort of self-reinforcing process. Right, we're going to take it, put it together to use that's, you know, that the colonial state thinks is, you know, quote unquote, the right use. And then when you try to change that, they'll say, well, you don't have the means to actually engage with the state.
Yeah, there is different, they use different strategies. One was just flat out denial, another was to tax your land, and another was just to deny you when you were in the lineup to get your own land.
What's the settlement that's being proposed today in the negotiations that have flown out of this long history?
Yeah, so eventually in the 1990s, the Algonquin land claim and self-government process was accepted by the federal and provincial governments. And now it's been, you know, whatever, over 20 years. The offer, I'm going to use it offer, which, you know, put that word in quotes, they're offering $300 million and 1.3% of our traditional territory. But it's really important that I stress that I'm only talking about the Algonquins of Ontario, that land claim. This is not even considering the Quebec Algonquins. So again, they're offering us $300 million and 1.3% of our land.
you've called the current land claims process a continuation of sort of colonial policy because, as you say, it sort of aims to terminate and extinguish the larger part of the claim rather than establish rights, right? Something that's, is it right to understand it that, you know, one of your criticisms is that it's basically kind of a negation rather than affirmation of claims?
Yes, absolutely. And it is. They're just using a different language. So in the historic treaty, they would say cede, release, yield, and surrender. And then they started using the word extinguish. And that was, of course, a real issue for indigenous people. And then they just tweaked the language. And now they call it relinquish or release or define your rights completely. And those they're just language tweaks or word tweaks. The underlying practice remains the same, where they're continuing to deny our jurisdiction, our rights to land and water, our rights to have our own self-government system, and it is about that. It's about the elimination of who we are, the termination of who we are, and the genocide of who we are.
What would it mean for the Canadian state? I mean, it's hard to think even at this point. What would it mean for the state to enter a more legitimate process, you know, whether it's negotiation or what have you? What would this actually mean?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's a big question. Of course, on the ground, it basically means sharing the jurisdiction of sharing the land and the resources that come from it. I like what Kira Ladner says, is there is a need for the return of a treaty federal order where Indigenous people have jurisdiction of the land and resources versus the current provincial federal order where you know, Canada gave the provinces our land and resources. So, on the ground, it means sharing land and resources. It certainly does not mean giving us jurisdiction of 1.3% of our territory and a $300 million buyout. I think what Canadians really need to understand is that when settlers came here, we allowed them to be here to share with us. We gave them some jurisdiction. We did not give them the right to overpower us and take away our jurisdiction. We gave them jurisdiction. And the relationship, I think a really good model is of course the Tuwo Wampum Belt that talks about nations living in parallel beside one another, where each nation has their own education system, their own legal system, their own healthcare system, and they both exist and thrive for the people, side by side.
And Lynn, maybe to wrap up, this is something that I think is interesting to me. How does this differ? How does this whole process differ between sort of more urban and more land-based contexts? You know, even in the same nation such as Algonquin, which has a major center like Ottawa within its land claim, how is this process of living together and combine and, you know, in jurisdictions sort of side by side going to look in more urban and more land-based contexts?
Yeah, I find that question interesting because, you know, urban centers are land-based.
Yeah.
I think you mean like by urban Indians. Well, I think people have to, if we were to enter into a genuine treaty relationship with Indigenous people, their treaty rights that they would gain would be portable. It would move with them wherever they were. I find sometimes I look at it in a really grounded way. I think sometimes people go, well, gee, how will that work out? And I don't think it's as complicated as people think it is, because there's no reason why you can't have, you know, schools side by side where one is teaching Western philosophy and another one is teaching Indigenous philosophy. There's no reason why they can't be side by side in an urban center. And the same with, you know, with healthcare. So I don't think it's as complicated as people think it is. And for example, Aboriginal Legal Services of Toronto, they have the Gladue Court, and that's occurring in an urban center.
Right. So as long as there's a population that can sort of, you know, a larger population of First Nations that can sustain a school or something like that, or even have programs that are side by side. As you say, and we have, you know, French immersion programs and things like that, where there's a different course.
Yes, yeah, and you know, keep in mind, if you really want to ground this, and it's not a funny thing, although I just chuckled, you know, there's a lot of homeless people in urban centers, and there's no reason why they cannot be accommodated in a way that is meaningful to them, right? I mean, they're already existing side by side.
Right, It's just now the disparity in resources is
Yeah.
the glaring distinction, right?
Yeah, yes. So is that does that bring some clarity? I don't think it is as complicated as people think it is.
No, that's that. I think that's an excellent way of putting it. Thanks again, Lingo.
Oh, and thank you for having me. And can I just plug my book? It's called The Truth That Wampum Tells, My Debwaywin on the Algonquin Land Claim Process. And I published it with Fernwood. It just came out in April, and that's what my article in part is based on. And by the way, I did co-author the article with Heather Majuri.
I did forget to, I will mention that in the intro.
Okay.
And I'll make sure to include a link to your book as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Take care.
That was Lynn Gale, Algonquin writer and researcher on the land claims process. That's it for today. Talk to you again in 2 weeks.